So I'm sort of picking specifically on Peter Zion tonight because in the last few years, he's kind of become a big deal. And a lot of people I know have been reading his books, listening to his talks. If you don't know who Peter Zion is, his website describes him as an expert in geopolitics, the study of how place impacts financial, economic, cultural, political, and military developments. His books tend to be very, very data-driven. But the data doesn't interpret itself, and so he starts with a story. So a historical story that frames his data and gives it meaning. In his book, Accidental Superpower, Peter Zion describes how after World War II, the United States was the only remaining nation with an intact economy. All the other countries, including the US allies, expected that the US would then do what all powerful nations do and colonize them. But the United States shocked the world by instead offering them, in the words of Peter Zion, a hell of a bribe to stand alongside the US against the Soviets in the Cold War. Zion writes, quote, "The three-point American plan was nothing short of revolutionary. They called it free trade. And all it would cost them," referring to the free European nations, "was accepting a security guarantee that was better than anything they could ever have achieved by themselves," unquote. Zion goes on, quote, "The collective result of the American scheme was not simply a firm break with the imperial era, but the active and enthusiastic cooperation of every meaningful non-Soviet power on the planet, without firing a shot or engaging in any more than the mildest of arm twisting. The Americans founded the greatest alliance in history while surrounding the Soviets with a thick hedge of hostile countries who were willing, even eager, to serve as the Americans' first line of defense against the Red Army," unquote. Okay, so basically, according to Zion, by having the United States become the security guarantor of the alliance network, nations within the economic alliance were able to leave behind the Hobbesian world of commercial competition by force and instead focus on achieving stable growth by building up trade networks within this peaceful and stable global system that would last for the remainder of the 20th century. In the words of Zion again, America, quote, "shaped the entirety of the world in which we now live. And that reshaping did the oddest thing. It turned geopolitics off," unquote. This is a good story. The theory behind this story doesn't originate with Zion, however. He's very much building off of the hegemonic stability theory, popularized by Charles Kindleberger. And in his 1973 work, The World in Depression, Kindleberger argued that just as states experience economic booms and busts without a nationally centralized monetary stabilizer, the 1929 worldwide Great Depression had occurred because of a lack of a global economic stabilizer. Kindleberger argued that after World War I, Britain was no longer able to play that international role. And so states had turned inwards, withdrawing from global commercial cooperation, each trying to independently race for economic recovery, leading to mass financial collapse and international mistrust, culminating in World War II, which was the result of the Axis powers attempting to access foreign natural resources through military expansion. What was needed, Kindleberger argued, was for the United States to shake off its isolationism and take Britain's place as the global dominant protective agency, which it finally did after World War II, thus creating the Cold War peace settlement described by Peter Zion. I would also like to just point out that Kindleberger was both a former employee of the US Federal Treasury, former US intelligence officer in the OSS, as well as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Lots more on them later. So quoting from Zion again, quote, "Throughout the past 70 years, the global system persists only because the Americans continue to pay the full price of sustaining it," unquote. And the popular claim here is that the United States has been willing to cover the global cost of the free rider problem because America has this unique commitment to the ideals of liberalism and its tenets of free trade, democracy, and human rights. As political scientist G. John Eikenberry put it, "Americans are less interested in ruling the world than they are in a world of rules." Now, according to this narrative, rather than enforcing order through brute strength, the United States encouraged state dependence on international organizations such as NATO, the IMF, World Bank, and the WTO. Rather than having to threaten non-compliant nations then with gunboat diplomacy, the liberal international order was instead able to resort to the use of non-violent tariffs and sanctions. As following Kindleberger's premise, in 1991, when the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact collapsed, Francis Fukuyama famously declared in the title of his book that it was the end of history. The only opponent to the U.S. policed international liberal order had just joined that order. We had finally achieved peace in our time. Now, 30 years later, we might be wondering what happened to that promised peace in our time. If the United States had managed to achieve worldwide hegemony, and as Peter Zion declared, turned off geopolitics, then why is it supposedly turning back on? Now, amid escalating global conflicts, Zion and other policy experts are constantly warning that the U.S. is turning its back on its hegemonic commitment to the global liberal international order, and that as a result, we are about to enter a quote-unquote scared new world. However, built into this warning is the assumption that after World War II, the U.S. did in fact, create a stable, liberal, international world order. And I'd like to take a look at what actually prompted the U.S. to seek global dominance and then examine the effects of that attempt. So the way that Peter Zion tells the story, the United States accidentally became the global hegemon due to geography and also thanks to accidental history by being the only state with an intact economy after World War II. As historians Stephen Wertheim and Dale Copeland have demonstrated in their works, this isn't quite the full story, and that years before the end of World War II, even before Pearl Harbor, United States policy planners had very carefully worked out the need for and the plan by which the U.S. would quote-unquote dominate the world. So prior to this, prior to World War II, the United States had existed as an interventionist hegemon in the Americas, and had jealously guarded the Western Hemisphere from European powers. At the same time, the U.S. had purposefully stayed out of entangling alliances in Europe, refusing to join the League of Nations after World War I, not out of a commitment to isolationism, but because the League would have reduced the U.S. to a global alliance of equals, thereby restricting U.S. freedom of action. Plus, the balance of power in Europe was satisfactory to U.S. interests, with their former allies, France, and Britain defining European politics and commerce. And then everything fell apart when in 1939, Germany and the Soviet Union joined forces. And then the following year, France collapsed and Britain was pushed off the continent. The U.S. fear at this point was not of military attack. Stephen Wertheim writes that U.S. foreign policy experts, quote, were not anticipating an invasion of the U.S. homeland. And few believed that a transoceanic attack could succeed against a well-defended Western Hemisphere, even if Germany were to defeat Britain, unquote. Rather, the shift in the balance of power in Europe meant that the U.S. was now facing commercial isolation. Suddenly, U.S. policy planners had to rethink whether the Western Hemisphere was sufficient for American markets. The State Department put the Council on Foreign Relations Economic and Financial Group on the problem. And in November of 1940, the CFR group concluded that, quote, the United States should use its military power to protect the maximum possible area of the non-German world from control by Germany in order to maintain for its sphere of interest a superiority of economic power over that of the German sphere, unquote. Now, this would require the U.S. to hold, quote, unquote, unquestioned power across what they termed the grand area, as well as full American commitment to defending this grand area from all intrusion by Germany or the Soviet Union. Thus, months before formally entering the war, the United States committed itself to funding and arming the nations in the grand area via the Lend-Lease Act in order to help form what President Roosevelt declared would be a global new order of the ages, his words. And already, the CFR was planning for a victorious American century with an ever-increasing grand area. But as they noted in their planning, this would require an active interventionist role in global politics, not the passive one that had allowed Europe to nearly be swallowed by Nazi Germany. Stephen Wertheim recounts how U.S. policy planners concluded that, quote, internationalism had it backwards. Rather than progressively overcoming coercion and conflict, peaceful intercourse, paradoxically, required armed forces to back it. In the epoch to come, whichever nation possessed military supremacy would impose its concept of world order, unquote. According to the policy document JCS 570, the post-war settlement was going to require a massive expansion of American military bases across the globe. And to this end, the CFR planners actually applauded the destruction that Germany and Japan had wrought on the old world order. The Axis had wiped the slate clean for U.S. supremacy. Military pushback was not the main concern now. Rather, the CFR was intensely worried that the American populace lacked the necessary enthusiasm for the level of heavy-handed interventionism such a policy would require. And in the midst of the war, between 1942 and 1945, foreign policy elites railed against isolationism, possibly more than they had before the war, especially since by 1943, they were realizing that global supremacy was going to be challenged by the Soviet Union, who had demonstrated that they hoped to be able to define their own hemispheric interests, which were fundamentally at odds with those of the US, both commercially, economically, and ideologically. The economic destruction of the old imperial powers had opened a door to the United States, but it was one that the Soviets might just as easily walk through, and so the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was formed. The CFR plan now, the one that had been designed for containing Germany, now switched to the Soviet Union, even while the war against Hitler was still waging. Historian Timothy Sale has done a solid job in demonstrating that again. As with the Germans in World War II, policy planners in Washington were not especially concerned that the Soviets were going to militarily conquer Europe. NATO Deputy Supreme Commander Bernard Montgomery stated that he thought it virtually certain that there would be no major war in Europe into the foreseeable future. And rather, what alarmed NATO leaders was what was termed the Soviet peace offensive, that without an overt Soviet threat, Western European countries might independently choose neutrality with the Soviet bloc, pulling Europe out of the U.S. orbit. As one report to President Eisenhower put it, the quote, main threat was not military aggression, but subversion by propaganda, economic bribery, and political penetration, unquote. If the Soviets could dissolve NATO via democratic means, then once again, the United States would not be the one defining the balance of power in Europe. Having the U.S. control this balance of power was why NATO was thus formed. And in a quote attributed to Lord Ismay, NATO's first Secretary General, NATO was formed to keep the Soviet Union out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. The plan here was that the European countries would collectivize and outsource their national security to NATO, where the U.S. could then define their commitment to the anti-Soviet alliance, free of democratic meddling, and free of independent European national concerns. However, again and again, NATO policy planners worried that the alliance existed despite the desires of American and European citizens, who would prefer to seek an entente with the Warsaw Pact. And for its entire existence, NATO leaders constantly expressed a crisis of relevance. However, fortunately for NATO, European governments saw that having the United States cover the cost of European security meant that they could instead focus on funding welfare programs and revitalizing their overseas empires. And this is where we begin to really see that the term Cold War is such a misnomer. And there's this popular belief that the Third World is, for one reason or another, inherently unstable. But this ignores the fact throughout almost the entirety of the Cold War, these were the border regions, the borderlands where the hot wars were being waged to make the world safe for either US or Soviet hegemony. And World War II had ravaged and bankrupted Europe, forcing countries like Britain to continue food rationing through into the mid-1950s. And even so, in the early post-war years, the Western European nations began pushing expansive welfare programs as a way to secure their governments and buy off their populations away from communism. And for this, they needed direct access to the natural resources in their colonies. Third world countries that had eagerly been looking forward to the promise declared in the Atlantic Charter of Self-Determination responded angrily to the colonial resurgence, sparking uprisings against the Dutch in Indonesia, the British in India, Ceylon, Burma, Palestine, Malaya, Kenya, Egypt, and Oman, Belgians in Congo and Rwanda, and the French in Syria, Algeria, Madagascar, Indochina, Morocco, Cameroon, Guinea, and I'm sure I'm probably missing some here. These wars were brutal, involving the widespread use of concentration camps to confine populations, labor camps, widespread use of torture by the European empires, militarily targeting civilians, and mass rape in the case of the French troops in Algeria. Historian A.G. Hopkins writes, quote, "In 1945, the Allies anticipated that reformed, progressive empires would advertise the merits of the Western way of life. By the mid-1950s, amidst colonial wars, emergencies, continuing unrest, and manifest poverty, the record had fallen far short of expectations," unquote. And thus, after years of brutal and costly wars, most of the European powers began to cut their losses and grant independence to the remaining colonies that they still retained, with most of them closing their colonial departments by the end of the 1960s. But even then, European imperialism unofficially continued on. In Africa, former French colonies were only granted independence on the condition that their currency would be tied to the French franc, and both French and British companies were granted monopolistic control over natural resources in their former colonies. And in many of these places, there's been an ongoing European military presence right up to the present day. And actually, Brad Pierce has written multiple articles on recent European interventions in Africa on his Substack, The Wayward Rabbler, and I'd like to particularly plug his material since he happens to be here with us today. So, and the United States did not just play a passive role, but was willing to fund and even militarily support European imperialism when it was seen as beneficial to their own strategic planning. However, for many of the colonies fighting for independence, they had looked specifically to the United States as the anti-imperialist nation and believed that they had been betrayed by the U.S. These countries then turned to the only nation that would sell them arms and munitions, the Soviet Union, thus escalating what had been local wars of independence into global proxy struggles between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. One of the most violent examples of this occurred in the Belgian Congo, which happened to be a region rich in uranium deposits, and thus of great interest to both the United States and the Soviet Union. So when in 1960 a war for independence against the Belgians began, the democratically elected president Patrice Lumumba was assassinated with CIA assistance, and a more friendly dictator, Mobutu, inserted in his place, throwing the country into civil war. And Mobutu would basically destroy his country over the course of the next 20 years, while the conflict spilled over into all the neighboring countries in shockingly brutal warfare that included UN troops, French troops, Belgians, Americans, South Africans, and hundreds of thousands of Russians, Chinese, and Cubans, leading to the deaths of untold millions of people and warfare right up to the present. Such famous events as the genocide in Rwanda and the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe are all related to their participation in this conflict. The repeated lessons that U.S. planners learned from examples such as this was that third world democracies were more interested in national sovereignty than in fighting the Cold War. And U.S. policy thus showed not only a preference for dictators, but also in overthrowing democracies in favor of dictatorships. And realizing this, international corporations then took advantage of U.S. politics and on multiple occasions managed to acquire U.S. interventions by recasting their own struggles with third world governments as part of the Cold War conflict. And thus, the CIA helped to overthrow the democratically elected government in Iran in 1953 at the behest of British Petroleum, sparking blowback there in the Ayatollah. Guatemala in 1954 for the United Fruit Company, leading to 4 decades of civil war and genocide. And also Chile In 1973 for Pepsi Cola and the International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation, ITT, based out of New York. And in none of these examples were these governments seeking rapprochement with the Soviet Union. And while elsewhere in politically unstable regions, the CIA helped to create military coups and install US-friendly dictators all over Latin America. In the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Brazil, Bolivia, and Argentina. And in fact, by the end of the 1970s, basically every single Latin American country had been placed under a military dictatorship characterized by mass incarceration, torture, and murder of political dissidents. These countries were then placed on U.S. foreign aid programs, like the Alliance for Progress, to help financially prop up their autocratic regimes against Cuba. And a similar program was followed throughout the Middle East in brutal dictatorial countries such as Iran under the Shah, the UAE, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, who received vast sums of military equipment and support from the US in the Arab Wars against Egypt and Yemen, which were in turn being backed by the Soviet Union as a result of their anti-colonial war against Britain and France. Again and again, the same narrative played out over the course of the Cold War. Unbelievably corrupt foreign governments that wanted U.S. money or weapons could receive them if they could convince the U.S. government that they were part of the Cold War. Or if they wanted their misdeeds ignored, all they had to do was make themselves an indispensable ally to the U.S. cause. What this meant, though, was that the United States had to militarily and financially support dictatorships while downplaying or denying their acts of terrorism and genocide. And this included Indonesia, when in 1965, the CIA helped to back a military coup by General Suharto, which resulted in a national purge against anyone even supposedly connected with the communists. Actual numbers are unknown, but perhaps as many as over 1 million Indonesians were killed. Suharto then remained as the military dictator of Indonesia and an ally to the United States until his resignation in 1998. His 32-year dictatorship is considered one of the most brutal and corrupt of the 20th century. And then in 1971, the Pakistani government, in an attempt to end the Bangladesh bid for independence, began ethnically cleansing all the Hindus there, killing possibly as many as 3 million Bengalis, raping 400,000 women, and displacing 30 million people from the region. Unfortunately for the people of Bangladesh, the ethnic cleansing occurred right when President Nixon needed Pakistan to back him up as part of the negotiations with China. So the U.S. turned a blind eye to the atrocities committed there. And then in the 1980s, the Contras were waging a brutal terrorist war against the equally terroristic Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And when Congress denied further funding to the Contras, President Ronald Reagan and Vice President George H. Bush, who was also the former director of the CIA, attempted to find alternative means of supplying the Contras by selling weapons to the Ayatollah and Iran, despite the U.S. embargo there, and then using the proceeds from the weapon sales to fund the Contras. And all this while the Contras were smuggling cocaine into the U.S., helping to spark the crack cocaine epidemic. And then finally, I'd like to turn quickly to Europe, since that's probably where we're going to point to if we're, other than the United States, that is, as an example of the Cold War being cold. However, here as well, the history is a little more complicated than that. So all through World War II, the United States, via the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, had helped to fund and arm guerrilla units and resistance movements against the fascists in France, Holland, Belgium, Italy, and Greece. And many, if not most, of these groups were largely communist. And thus, through their resistance against the Nazis, the communists in these countries had a solid position from which to shape the reconstruction of their newly liberated nations. So it was necessary, therefore, that the United States make sure that leftists did not achieve power in Europe, either by democratic election or revolution. As World War II ended, and the political lines of the Iron Curtain were being drawn, the OSS and later the CIA and NATO began placing stay-behind guerrilla units in countries that they thought might fall into the Soviet orbit. These undercover units were then tasked with waging resistance campaigns against any communist governments that emerged. And who better to recruit for these units than fascists and Nazis that had just been fighting the communists in World War II. The chief of German operations at CIA headquarters remarked on the widespread use of known Nazi war criminals, quote, "It had nothing to do with morals or ethics, and everything to do with security," unquote. And another remarked that, quote, "American intelligence is a blind man, using the Abwehr," to the former Nazi intelligence department, "as a seeing eye dog. The only trouble is, the leash is much too long," unquote. As I had mentioned earlier, officials in NATO repeatedly stressed the need to keep Western Europe's military defense and foreign policy planning out of the hands of democratic governments. And so the Stay Behind program, originally designed to prepare units to possibly fight in regions taken over by communist governments, was expanded to become a communist deterrent program all over Europe. Now, for decades, these groups secretly operated all over Europe, only officially coming to light in August of 1990, when the Italian, Swiss, and Belgian governments investigated NATO's Operation Gladio and publicly revealed that the NATO Allied Clandestine Committee, ACC, had created secret parallel government organizations in all 16 NATO countries, as well as multiple neutral ones, including Austria, Finland, Sweden, and Switzerland. Although these groups had been formed supposedly to resist communist expansion and to combat left-wing terrorist groups that had emerged, it was exposed that NATO, the CIA, and MI6 had trained, funded, and armed right-wing terrorist groups that had actively participated in what was known as the Years of Lead from 1969 to the end of the Cold War, during which time Italy alone had over 8,000 terrorist attacks. Now, actions by these NATO-supported cells, including bombings of trains and market squares, shootings, assassinations, coups, torture, election fraud, disinformation, and also false flag terrorist acts used to discredit the communist left wing. And some of the more famous acts by these groups were the French OAS attempted military coup and assassination of French President de Gaulle, and the Turkish Grey Wolves attempted assassination of Pope Benedict. In November of 1990, the European Parliament passed a resolution condemning these, quote, "decision-making and operational bodies which are not subject to any form of democratic control and are of a completely clandestine nature," unquote. And these organizations which had been, quote, "involved in serious cases of terrorism and crime as evidenced by various judicial inquiries," unquote. In the words of one historian, the goal had been to make democracy safe for America. So in conclusion, what do we do with this information? And U.S. policy planners worked very hard to try to become the global hegemon. And while lip service was given to national sovereignty, free trade, and democracy, they were never the original goal, and in fact were quickly discarded when inconvenient. Zion claims that the U.S. chose not to militarily colonize the world in 1945. But for the majority of peoples around the globe, it didn't look much different. In the words of Tacitus, they make a wasteland and call it a peace. And this isn't to claim that everyone in the U.S. government or policy planning is evil, nor that this is unique to the United States. I mean, the Soviets were over there doing the exact same thing. But I think that the sordid history of U.S. intervention is important because it tells a story contrary to the hegemonic stability theory that the system inherently incentivizes further interventions, cronyism, and misallocation of resources, including violence. The history of the Cold War is one of intervention that begat intervention, which caused blowback, requiring further correction. And all of this has been prohibitively expensive. I feel bad bringing up the cost of this in money when, you know, we're counting the lives here. But take, for example, just Israel. The U.S. has spent $300 billion adjusted for inflation on Israel alone, because back in 1948, they said that without U.S. support, Israel would collapse. Well, 70 years later, and we're still spending $3.8 billion annually, and apparently it's still not stable. Military expenditure is our number one expense, and in 2022, we spent over $877 billion on the military, which is about 40% of the military expenditure worldwide. And then a few months ago, I saw a Wall Street Journal article saying that the U.S. government military spending is about to be eclipsed by $1.1 trillion in additional interest payments. So chew on that. Now, one could reply to all this death and taxes and say, well, you know, to make an omelet, you have to break a few eggs. Or as Madeleine Albright responded when told that the U.S. embargo back in the 1990s on Iraq had killed 500,000 children, well, we think the cost has been worth it. Okay, we could have that debate, but that's a very different framing than the one being presented when people like Peter Zeihan or Una Hathaway and the internationalists warn against the U.S. backing away from global supremacy. Because the last 80 years have supposedly been a stable period of U.S.-imposed liberal order. If we don't understand cause and effect in our past, then we're not going to understand our present. We've spent so much of the 20th century metaphorically and in actuality running up debt on endless credit. And we've pointed to our material accumulations as evidence that we're morally and politically right. And then when the creditors start calling, our response has been that either, well, we just didn't spend enough, or our problem is with the limitation on the credit cards. Now, we're not insane people doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different result. No, what we have is amnesia, and we don't remember how we got here. And we think that the credit card high of our parents' generation is the status quo, or worse, that it's our birthright as 21st century Americans. I think we're already seeing the disillusionment and the intellectual flailing as the music begins to slow down. I'll leave you with that. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the George Buchanan Forum Conference. We have many more that you can check out at our website at tgbf.org. You can also find us on YouTube or on your favorite podcasting platform. In true free market fashion, we're entirely crowdfunded by the generous support of people like you. If you'd like to help our work, you can set up one-time or recurring donations at tgbf.org. The best way for others to hear about us is from their friends. So please consider liking, subscribing, and sharing our material. We greatly appreciate it.